A News. I'm Bob Levicky. The conservative majority on the Supreme Court sides with Governor Youngkin over his voter purge. Meanwhile, Waynesboro voters wait on a judge to rule in a legal battle over the certification of the city's election results. And bats are a scary symbol of Halloween, but they're an essential and helpful part of our ecosystem. This is the WMRA Daily for this Halloween Thursday, October 31st. The U.S. Supreme Court sided with Governor Glenn Youngkin on Wednesday and allowed his plan to remove potential non-citizens from Virginia's voting rolls to resume. Virginia Public Radio's Brad Kuttner has more.
Governor Glenn Youngkin took to Fox News Wednesday morning to celebrate an order from the U.S. Supreme Court that allowed his administration to continue a controversial voter purge program.
Well, as you can imagine, I'm incredibly pleased with the decision today, and the Supreme Court reacted quickly. And this is a victory for common sense.
At an event in Petersburg a bit later, the governor asked reporters not to tell Virginians the program was cutting legal citizens from voter rolls, but instead was an effort to stop non-citizen voters from voting. Reporting by Radio IQ could not find one incident of non-citizen voting in the Commonwealth in the last 20 years. And one Central Virginia voter who spoke with us Tuesday said she was improperly removed even after attempting to remedy the issue. The voter was eventually able to re-register. But Ryan Snow, one of the attorneys who argued against the purge, said similar stories of disenfranchisement were not uncommon.
We know that Virginia's voter purge has removed eligible voters. We've spoken to many of them. I've personally spoken with several, including one who became naturalized over 30 years ago and has been voting in every election since. And voting is very important to him. And he didn't even receive the removal notice. He didn't understand. He went to check his registration and found that he'd been removed.
Youngkin said those who were improperly removed from the rolls can use Virginia's same-day registration law to vote on Election Day in person. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
The Reverend Cozy Bailey, president of the Virginia State Conference of the NAACP, called the Supreme Court's decision, quote, egregious. Bailey also says Virginia's efforts are characteristic of voter suppression steps the Youngkin administration has previously taken.
I will tell you that this administration absolutely understands and knows that many, if not most, of those who are negatively impacted are in fact legally naturalized citizens and in some cases, natural born citizens.
The state NAACP, along with the national office, said they will continue to fight for voter access and equality. The Supreme Court's ruling means that localities now have to navigate even more early and election day difficulties. WAMU's Margaret Barthel reports that could affect U.S. citizens attempting to vote.
Since August, Virginia has removed about 1,600 voters from the rolls after state DMV data suggested they may not be U.S. citizens and they didn't attest their citizenship in time. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin insists the program targets non-citizens, but reporting from NPR and other outlets suggests that U.S. citizens have also been removed. Eligible voters who have been removed can still vote using same-day registration, says Samantha Shepard with the Loudoun Office of Elections.
You will fill out a new voter registration application that's on an envelope. You will be given a ballot. You can vote that ballot, and then that ballot will go into the envelope.
Local election boards check the accuracy of applications and accept or deny provisional ballots. Same-day registrants on election day must do so in the correct precinct. Shepard says Loudoun has no evidence that non-citizen voting is a significant problem in the county.
Margaret Barthel reporting. Less than a week before Election Day, Waynesboro voters are waiting on a judge to rule in a legal battle over the certification of the city's election results. WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports.
In early October, two of Waynesboro's three electoral board members filed suit against the commissioner of the Virginia Department of Elections and the chairman of the Board of Elections. The lawsuit argues that the way Virginia uses ballot counting machines is unconstitutional. In affidavits, Curtis Lilly II and Scott Mayers asserted they will not certify the 2024 election until such time as the legal regime permits for hand-counting ballots and certification would not result in a violation of the Virginia Constitution. Five Waynesboro voters filed a countersuit, asking the court to order Lilly and Mayers to perform their duties and certify the city's election results. Judge Paul Dreyer presided over an injunction hearing in the countersuit on Tuesday. The crux of the electoral board member's argument comes from a section of the Virginia Constitution, which reads, quote, "The ballot box or voting machine shall be kept in public view and shall not be opened, nor the ballots canvassed, nor the votes counted in secret," end quote. Their attorney, Thomas Ranieri of Front Royal, argued that because the local board of elections cannot watch the internal machinery counting the votes, inspect the machine's programming, or confirm the result's accuracy with a hand count, the canvass is secret. Therefore, the method of election administration is unconstitutional, and the board cannot certify that the results are accurate. He told WMRA in a phone interview,
"We care very much that everyone who votes has their vote accurately recorded and has their voice actually matter, rather than leaving it up to the very general sort of reassurance that everything is perfectly fine. Like, reason we're concerned is when we really look down into the granular election stuff, it's not. There's nothing really there to make sure that someone's vote is being counted, Republican or Democrat. And so I want to feel like I know who actually won an election. I feel like most people would want to know that."
The voters' attorneys from the D.C. firm Crowell & Mooring and the Advancement Project argued in court that their clients have a constitutional right to suffrage that will be infringed if the board members refuse to certify. Jennifer Lewis is one of the voter plaintiffs and a former Democratic candidate for the House of Representatives.
"I definitely don't think that there's any validity to their argument. This is purely political, purely a way to disenfranchise voters and to make, you know, just muddy up the system."
The Voters' Council called Edgardo Cortez as a witness. He served as Virginia's first commissioner of elections from 2014 to 18 and gave about 2 hours of testimony on the details of how the counting machines are vetted by federally certified laboratories, tested for accuracy before each election, and what electoral board members are asked to do. That includes ensuring that the number of voters checked into each precinct match the number of votes cast there, and transporting sealed boxes of ballots to the clerk of the court after polling closes. Cortez said this challenge is unprecedented in Virginia, and there would be cascading effects from the failure of a local electoral board to certify, such as theoretically delaying Virginia from certifying the statewide election results. Ranieri told me that is not their goal.
"It will delay the state until they figure out how to certify it without them, you know, which they will. The quote-unquote need they have for certification, it sounds like more than anything else a bureaucratic need."
I asked Ranieri if he believes mistakes or fraud have occurred in ballot counting machines in Virginia.
"My perspective is that, like, again, that's not really relevant to my argument. I don't know if it's accurate or not. I have no way of checking."
The lawsuit is supported by a new organization Ranieri formed called Restore Virginia LLC, which aims to get laws off the books that violate the Virginia Constitution. He said the idea for this challenge came from a man named Daryl Bowe. Ranieri met him and a woman named Jocelyn White Heingardner at the GOP state convention and started discussing the concept this summer. Those two connected Ranieri to the Waynesboro board members. I reached out to Heingardner, who serves as the secretary for Virginia's 6th District Republican Committee. She directed my questions to Ranieri. The legal watchdog group, CREW, has identified 25 similar cases in 7 states. In the cases where local officials initially delayed or denied certification, they did eventually certify the results, sometimes under pressure from a state agency or court order. Ranieri expects the court will order his clients to certify the election, and for them to comply. Then, next week's election could proceed as planned, and they could appeal the court's decision afterward.
"But ultimately, what we're actually asking for is just to have an administration of an election that follows the Constitution as well as those laws in the Virginia statutes that don't contradict the Virginia Constitution."
Lewis said local voters are worried about how the case will affect this election.
"I go out door knocking every day. And when I'm talking to voters, they are concerned about this. When this story is posted on social media, the comments, people are like, is my vote going to count? Is it, like, what's happening?"
At the end of Tuesday's hearing, Judge Dreyer said he would issue a ruling on the voters' request for an injunction as soon as practicable. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
Learn more about that case through links we posted at WMRA.org and on the app. Well, the commercial airwaves are being flooded with political ads, but many of them are not from the candidates or their campaigns. They're paid for with outside spending from political action committees. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
Campaigns tend to have political ads that celebrate their candidates or maybe attack an opponent, but those ads are nothing like a PAC attack, which often go for the jugular, attacking candidates for not showing up to public meetings or having a fake family. Democratic strategist Ben Tribbett says it's important to remember the firewall between the candidates and the PACs who love them.
One side of the organization works directly with candidates, and the other side works for independent expenditures like this. And their ads are always sort of the creative side of probably what a candidate would like to say, but doesn't want to put their own name on.
Jeff Ryer is a Trump campaign spokesman in Virginia, and he says PACs are playing the game with a different set of rules.
The challenge for the PACs is that they have to get the most bang for their buck. And the reason why is, while candidates are allowed seriously discounted advertisements, the PACs pay retail. And that usually means that they have to both raise more and spend more, even if they end up with less.
The clear winner in all the TV ad wars? The television stations. All the attack ads mean windfall profits, especially for the Hampton Roads media market and the Washington, D.C. media market, which includes Northern Virginia. I'm Michael Pope.
Yola Dance resigned from her position as the Montpelier Foundation's president and CEO earlier this month. Her exit comes 14 months after she took the role. Before joining Montpelier, she worked with the National Park Service, including at the Maggie L. Walker National Historic Site in Richmond and Fort Monroe in Hampton. Chief Operating Officer Krista Costello is slated to become Dance's interim replacement at the Montpelier Foundation. It is Halloween, and that means it's time for spooky ghosts and scary bats. But Brad Kuttner spoke to one researcher who argues that bats, including Virginia's own state bat, are more helpful than scary.
After Dave Waldeen left the Army, went to college, and spent a weekend on an assignment studying bats, he fell in love.
It's just that diversity of what they do that intrigued me.
Waldeen said bats play an important part in our ecosystems and also our economies. They act as pollinators for some of your favorite tropical fruits, like agave fruit for tequila, and help keep pest populations low here in the U.S.
Bats are saving farmers billions of dollars every year.
Virginia also has its own state bat, the Virginia big-eared bat. It was designated by the legislature about 20 years ago, and while Waldeen hasn't seen the state bat in person, in part because of its endangered status, he said the name accurately describes them.
It's got these huge ears, hence its name. It has a couple of lumps on its nose.
The ears and nose bumps are likely part of echolocation, the use of high-frequency sound to hunt for food, but you're unlikely to hear those calls at night. When you hear them, like this group of Virginia big-eared bats via a Virginia Department of Wildlife Resources video, those calls are bats communicating. Waldeen says they're probably not talking about harming you or your little ghosts and ghoulies either. The Virginia big-eared bat, like most bat species, are known to not attack humans. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Finally today, the Division of Perceptual Studies is an academic group from the University of Virginia devoted to the evidence for extraordinary human experiences. Founded in 1967, the group investigates the mind's relationship to the body and the possibility of consciousness surviving physical death. Dr. Marina Whaler is an assistant professor of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at UVA. And part of this effort, WMRE's Chris Boros asked her to describe the organization's work.
The Division of Perceptual Studies, or DOPS, how we called it for short, is a division inside the Department of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences in the School of Medicine, University of Virginia. And it was founded in 1967 by Ian Stevenson. So he started the division, and then eventually we expanded, and now almost 60 years later, we are studying a lot of other type of phenomena like near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, mediumship, remote viewing, wow, all these type of phenomena.
How did you find yourself working in this field and studying these amazing concepts?
Since my youth, I've had amazing experiences that I couldn't explain. I would have dreams with deceased, received messages and things happening to me that at the time I couldn't explain. And then when I started my undergrad in sciences, I learned that the road is physical. So everything that I believed and all my personal experiences, I had to put inside this drawer and label hallucination, which was very hard. But then when I started my grad school, I had a very good friend who is a physicist, and he would talk a lot about the spiritual world and how he believed in everything. And to me, I was shocked to see that he was such an intelligent person, a physicist, and he would still believe in the invisible world. And after I started reading the evidence, it was an intellectual choice to be in this field again, because once you open up and you study and you see the evidence, you can't unsee it anymore. I had no idea this type of research could be done scientifically. I had no idea this could be done at all. Like, how can we study the afterlife and things like that? And I was so fascinated about the topic. I just knew I wanted to work with this, and I was in love for Dobbs.
Did you struggle with, you know, on one hand, you had these experiences and you believe in your heart that these were real. And then on the other hand, you are a scientist, and a lot of people I would imagine in that world are going to foo-foo it and say, no. How hard was that for you to like kind of balance what was real and what wasn't?
It was very hard. Yeah. So the first shift that I had, which is from believing to not believing and becoming a physicalist, I was in my early 20s. And I had to reframe my entire road. But at the same time, it brought me down a little bit, because what's the meaning? Why am I here? Why are we here? That was a hard time, I would say. But then when I shift back, because of, like, I started reading the evidence and everything, it was, again, it requires a lot of cognitive accommodation. Everything that you believe, everything that you constructed in your life, and you had to reframe it again. So it was a lot easier than the previous shift, because, I don't know, to me, just finding meaning in our existence brought me peace.
Let's talk about some of the evidence. What happens typically when someone has an out-of-body experience?
So a very classic out-of-body experience, or OB, a person has a feeling that they are not in their physical bodies anymore. And suddenly they see themselves floating. Sometimes they may see their physical bodies resting or napping or sleeping, and it's a very vivid and a very real experience. Some of these experiences can be very short and last seconds, and once people realize that's my body, they're very scared, and they suddenly go back to their bodies and they kind of have the feeling of waking up. Sometimes they last longer and people kind of enjoy the feeling and go flying around. They want to see what's outside.
I want to happen. Yeah. I want that.
And they want to explore other rooms and see what people are doing. Some other experiences, people go to different realms and different dimensions and see entities. Sometimes people meet deceased loved ones and they receive messages. So OBEs are a very complex, the experiences vary a lot between people.
That was a sample of our interview with Dr. Marina Wehler from the Division of Perceptual Studies at UVA. Later today, Chris Boros and Kimberly Daggy will share more from the interview. To learn more about her research and to hear the full conversation, visit WMRA.org. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and happy Halloween.